This is an interview with Reverend Bert Campbell, First Presbyterian Church, the Youngstown State University's Oral History Program concerning the shutdown of the Youngstown Sheet and Tube, and his participation as a member of the Steering Committee of the Ecumenical Coalition at the First Presbyterian Church on April the 28th, 1981, at 12:30.
Reverend Campbell, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and so forth?
I was born in Kingman, Arizona. I grew up in Wheeling, West Virginia. Went to Pittsburgh, went to West Liberty State College outside of Wheeling, and graduated with a degree in drama and speech. Went to Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. I graduated in 70. Spent 8 years, 6 years there, developing an ecumenical ministry of some 30 churches and a staff of somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 to 48 people, working with those churches in the community. Came to Youngstown, Ohio in January 1 of 1976 and received my doctorate of ministry at McCormick Theological Seminary in 1979. I spent 8 years during college and first part of seminary working in steel mills and served on union grievance committees and sundry positions.
What kind of jobs did you do in the mill?
I was a lidman on top of the coke ovens, worked in the blast furnaces, and then was a welder in a fabricating division of Wheeling-Pittsburgh Steel.
Do you recall where you were and how you found out about the announcement of the shutdown of Youngstown Sheet and Tube?
Where I was that day?
Mm-hmm. And how you, the first
that you first heard. Reactions I had to it, with those that I had received, that I received when I went home and I picked up the paper. I really was not too aware of what was going on prior to that. I was aware of a number of the concerns, for in fact, that Sunday that the announcement was being made, First Presbyterian Church entertained Stoughton Lind, who spoke to a number of our people during an adult study forum on the concerns of the little man, the average labor member, who at that point was perhaps not being heard or supported by the International Union, nor heard or supported or concerned about by the varied corporations. So therefore, because we had been addressing the issue for two Sundays, concerns in the Valley, labor management, and because earlier that year, actually in the spring, we had done a four-week series on the concerns in the Valley and the revitalization of the Valley, in which Bill Sullivan, Ed Stanton, and a number of other individuals spoke, I was aware of the concerns. The immediate issue, though, I didn't find out about until I read it in the paper.
That was in your Church and Society Committee?
Church and Society Committee initiated the concern. It was then passed to Christian Education Committee that developed a four-week forum in the spring and then a two-week follow-up forum in the fall. We then received, as a matter of fact, front page coverage of that forum by Attorney Lind directly underneath the shutdown notice by Lights Corporation.
Where did the phrase ecumenical coalition come from?
To my understanding, when Bishop Burt and Bishop Malone first got together and called a number of individuals together, the discussions around the table at that point was something must be done, what ought to be done. There were subsequently two other meetings. I didn't go to the first meeting. I went to the second meeting. At that point, we came to the conclusion we had to do more and pray about the problem. We decided to have at least a conference in which we would try to get individuals there from some outstanding speakers, local concerned individuals, and so on. It was at that conference that I recollect the discussions were raised that there need to be a coalition of individuals. On the one hand, all the churches were gathered, and this was an ecumenical venture on the other hand, and somewhere in the midst of that, those two things flowed together, and this body emerged called the Ecumenical Coalition. Well, to my knowledge, there was never any design plan that had...
What I was getting at was it a creature of the press, did they dub you the Ecumenical Coalition, or did you just kind of assume that title yourself?
I think we assumed that title ourselves by means of descriptive phrase, not as a title. Mm-hmm. And then it was the easiest thing to then become a title.
How were you first made aware of the attempt by Bishop Burton, Bishop Malone, actually pulling you into the structure?
They called several individuals, bishop types, such as John Sherrick, who is our executive presbyter, but they also called several pastors, Gene Bay, who was my former partner here, was called because of the location of this institution and because of a number of the things that we had already been doing in this kind of arena. Gene and I talked about the issue, and because he was senior pastor at that point, I said, why don't you go? So he went to the first meeting, came back and suggested that I too ought to be going because of history and expertise. So by the second meeting, then I got called in. The question, though, of how did we first get in was that Burt or Malone, one of the two, contacted this institution.
You mentioned the second meeting. Do you recall when it was approximately?
It was approximately the second week after the closing. Somewhere during that week, and my guess is along about Wednesday or so of that week.
Okay. In the interim between the Steel Crisis Conference in October and the announcement of the shutdown, there was formation of a steering committee of which you were part, I understand.
No.
No? Okay.
The steering committee grew out of the Steel Conference. What happened was that during the conference, certain agendas were set, and there needed to be mechanisms to begin to carry out those agendas. During those discussions, it was determined that the bishop types, Sherrick, Malone, Burt, and so on, should sit down in a room and determine what they were going to be able to do to help move in any kind of direction. At that point, national representatives from the churches helped advise, and the bottom line was that each one committed so much money to begin to make this thing move. They, in turn, wanted their representatives, because obviously they're busy individuals who couldn't work day in and day out on the project. Out of that, when we came back to the meeting, the recommendation was made that we go with this coalition, that there then be a steering committee to assist the bishop types. And at that point, four of us were named: Ed Stanton, Father Stanton, to represent the Roman Catholic interest, myself to represent the United Presbyterian interest, Walton to represent the United Methodist, and who was the fourth? Sorry. and Chuck Rawlings to represent the Episcopal interest. That group was expanded somewhere toward the spring of the next year.
Was there, okay, just to kind of clarify the point, there was a kind of a two-tiered system. There was the executive committee, which was policy making, and the steering committee kind of
nuts and bolts.
Nuts and bolts. Stuff.
Nuts and bolts group that guided policy making because we were there, you know, looking at the particular issues as they came down.
But in the interim between the announcement of the shutdown and the actual conference in October, what took place? Just the two meetings, or were there?
Well, there were several other planning meetings, and at that point, I suppose you could say there was began to emerge a loose steering group, of which Gene Bay and myself, Ed Stanton, Lonnie Simon at a couple of points, Don Walton, Chuck Rawlings, emerged as helping that to move along. But we were really not there out of any kind of official capacity. It was a matter of, okay, we meet now, we've got some jobs to do. Let's go out and do them. We come back and meet who's going to do the next jobs, and so on. I would say at that point, even that early on, Ed Stanton and Chuck Rawlings began to lead more than anyone else did, mainly because they had the time to do it. They could be freed up by their respective bishops to go and do some jobs. It wasn't until after being named to that committee that this church determined that 20% of my time could be spent working in that capacity. So, you know, that's kind of how it developed.
Were there any specific individuals responsible for the agenda that evolved from the October 28th and 29th?
I would say that those individuals whom I've just mentioned probably designed it more than anyone else did, because we had contacts of individuals or could make contacts with individuals of the likes that we wanted to have there. And the individuals, getting the individuals there really began to determine the nature of the agenda. It wasn't that we had an agenda and then looked for people. You know, it was kind of a both and situation.
Was there any reason that the politicians were left out of that conference?
Very definitely. It appeared that in that interim period, all the politicians, political individuals, were raising concern and making statements. But it also appeared that none of them were taking any decisive leadership roles. So therefore, not to make it a political football or a political plum, and determining that we couldn't invite all the politicians, and determining that rhetoric would not allow us to get any work done, we decided that it would not include anyone who could receive any political gain from it.
Most of the persons at that particular meeting were clergy, except for perhaps the resource people. Is that the way I'm reading it?
Yes. And each church was asked to bring one lay representative, one lay person.
Okay. A couple of people, at least from the locals, were on the list. But could you tell me what efforts were made to contact the steelworkers as far as trying to get the participation?
Frank Lesiganich was contacted, as I understand, by Ed Stanton. The steelworkers had as their primary concern making sure that benefits and those kinds of needs were covered. A number of local steelworkers, representing at least one of the locals, began to say, look, that isn't all we want. We want to, you know, see if there isn't something else can be done. I and a number of others of us met with those individuals at St. John's Church, St. John's Episcopal Church, the night preceding the kickoff of the conference.
27th?
Okay. We sat around the table there and introduced ourselves. Several things happened there. One was that I don't think that the workers were taking the clerics too seriously. They were nice do-gooders, but what the hell could they do? At one point where I personally really felt things switched was when Stott and Lind, we went around and introduced ourselves. Stott and Lind interrupted and asked me to say a couple of more words about myself and prefaced it by saying, here is an individual who is pastor at the First Presbyterian Church in Youngstown, which had a particular image in the mindset of workers, I believe, in this community. Old, rich establishment used to be the Steel Baron Church. When the ball got thrown back to me for further introduction, Stoughton asked me to tell them a bit about my steelworking background. At which point, it appeared to me that a new level of credibility was inserted, and those discussions began to get more serious. Not because of me, but because I think the workers present, in the midst of their frustration, saw not only concern, but maybe some potentials of understanding and some power. So that emerged out of that meeting. Then we went into the meeting the next day, the conference the next day. Those workers, a lot more represented that night, heard spokesmen such as Philip Newell from the National Presbyterian offices talking about potential monies that could be available to do some things, and they began to see hope. The next day, we limited numbers of representatives simply to be able to have control of the situation.
The meeting before that you mentioned, that approximately how many persons attended that meeting?
My guess would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 or 30. And I would say there were no more than 6 clergymen at that meeting. The rest were individuals like, well, it would be more than 6, probably 7 or 8 counting national staff kinds of persons. And then you had individuals like Stott and Lind and people like that. So the rest would have been workers.
Okay. At the conference itself, were specific proposals set forth by any of the speakers as far as what direction to take?
I would not say that there were specific in the sense of laid out proposals.
Yeah.
I would say there were specific suggestions on how to go that ranged from one that would be more conservative, talking about diversification and those kinds of things by Bill Sullivan, to one being, really talking about some extreme kinds of concerns, which weren't directed to solutions then, they were directed to the problems done by Marcus Raskin, and Alperovitz. Really emerged at that point of talking about what can happen in local communities if people begin to take control of their own destiny. And so out of that kind of conversation, those were really the seeds that began to say, well, at one point Gerald Dickey stood up and asked the question, can't we try to take over a mill by ourselves? And that was one piece that eventually got in there. Concerns were raised by Bishop Thomas of the Methodist Church, who has a history in social action, and Black, which helped carry that message, to say we have to issue some statements of indignation of what's happened, the ethical questions. And that eventually was refined into one of our directions. Question was concerned or was raised, we need to investigate what the possibilities are. Further, maybe we need to hire, some people to do that investigation. So the idea of going out and getting consultants and so on began to emerge. So those kinds of pieces grew.
But the thrust of the meeting was not specifically to focus on a consultant, but strictly to just see what the policy
to gather information. Sure. It was an information gathering and sharing situation was what it was, first. And second, if there was a hidden agenda, I would say the hidden agenda was to be have the kinds of persons there, the caliber of which would speak of the dramatic. That, you know, this wasn't a bunch of do-gooder preachers just gathering, but in fact, we could bring together some very notable individuals to raise concern on the issue.
How did you come away from that conference? Did you feel that, I think there was a solid, what direction you were taking, and do you think there was a kind of clear consensus that there was hope that you should go forward?
Yes, very definitely, and that was evidenced by the fact that the four major denominations contributed $200,000 towards $250,000 for a war chest. When churches start talking about war chests, you're taking very seriously that you've got a task out there and you're willing to do it, because those kind of monies don't come very easily.
Four initiatives came out of the conference as a release from the coalition came out later. First, which was listed, was a draft of pastoral letter, which would state the moral and ethical issues, which was to be distributed, I believe, Thanksgiving Advent season. The second was to initiate a study of feasibility of community worker takeover of Campbell Works. The third was to advocate formulation of a national policy to retain basic steel and associate jobs in communities where steelworkers live. And finally, to focus national interest on Youngstown as a means of developing a model for retention of basic jobs in severely impacted communities. Okay, was anybody assigned a specific task? You handled this one and somebody handled something else?
No, the steering committee was assigned all four tasks, and we subsequently worked on each one of those and at different points, different times. And called in experts, on all of those. So no one took any one by itself and ran with it. We took the option of all of us working on all of it and set up timelines and where there were interplays.
So there was no subcommittees or anybody
No. We were the
you
we
three
were
to work on this and report back to the large group and we'll all...
Not at that juncture, no.
Okay. Subsequently, towards the end of December, on December the 20th, as a matter of fact, there was a meeting at the White House. First of all, I guess I should ask, did you attend that meeting?
The first meeting on the 20th?
Yes.
Who do you recall was there?
The release was kind of vague.
That was me?
Okay.
No, I was not at that meeting. I was at the meeting there the next meeting after that, when we went back with our act together.
Okay.
It was also at the meeting when we got our act together.
Okay. The Beetle Report was funded by Rita and the Coalition, and it was released December the 16th. Could you tell us a little bit about that, what the Beetle Report was?
Well, the Beetle Report... Beetle was essentially hired because of some of the coalition members' relationship to Bill Sullivan. Beetle was already doing a study. He was able to utilize the material within Youngstown Sheet and Tube, Life's Corporation information, and so was able to give us a brief sketch of what was there and what could happen whether it was even worth beginning to look at. That was essentially financed, at least better than 50% of it was financed through Western Reserve Economic Development.
On December 23rd, a mailgram was finally mailed to HUD and Commerce Department saying that the Ecumenical Coalition, in essence, was incorporated and they would serve as the main planning, I believe the term was agent, that you would get support from Congressman Carney, Mayor-elect Richley, and Frank Lessiganis, who also signed it, and that, I'm not sure the exact mechanism, but that Mr. Alpervitz's organization would do the actual planning. Did you attend the meeting with the congressman December 22nd? Could you relate who was there and...
Well, that was a press release.
Okay.
That was
the mailgram, right? I meant the meeting the previous day.
The meeting previous day?
Right.
Yes, there was Bishop Malone, Ed Stanton, myself, John Sherrick, I believe Frank Lessiganis, or someone representing the steelworkers. Possibly Jim Smith from the international office. I'm not sure whether Jim was there at that point. And Congressman Carney. Congressman Carney came in with an agenda to take the ball and run with it. Bishop Malone had a couple of introductory remarks. Congressman Carney gave his speech. Bishop Malone came back and said, "Now, as I was saying," and informed Congressman Carney that, in fact, we were not backing off, that, in fact, the Ecumenical Coalition was not going to give in to any kind of political gain, that, in fact, we were going to be the neutral agent. And if political personages didn't like it, we'd go public with the fact that they didn't like it for political purpose.
What was the thrust of Congressman Carney's argument, as you recall?
That we were good clerics, but we didn't know anything about the steel community and the economic issues, and that people who knew much more about that ought to take that ball and run with it now.
Well, given the fact that you had a proposal and that you were ready to incorporate, and they had no proposal at that point, it seemed kind of an irrational argument.
It was. That's why it didn't go very far. But at that point, you had moving. Another individual who was there was, he's dead now.
Jim Griffin.
The movement behind the scenes, as best I could understand it, was that two other organizations within the Mahoning Valley area wanted to get control of those funds, because it was a significant amount of dollars. One of them was there were two organizations, EDATA and MedVac, that wanted control of the funds for political reasons and a significant amount of dollars that we were talking about.
I'm going to jump back a step because of something you mentioned in the on October approximately the 10th, Congressman Carney held a meeting in Higbee's. Was anybody, to the best of your knowledge, invited from the Ecumenical Coalition?
No.
Okay. All right, then we'll move forward. Approximately February of 1978, Reverend Fernandez was appointed as director of Save Our Valley. First of all, who helped bring him on board, or was he on board already, and what was his expertise that he was chosen as director of that campaign?
Well, the steering committee had interviewed a number of individuals, I think three or four, and we had looked at a number of resumes. On that particular day, Chuck Rawlings brought Fernandez to town, and we were introduced to him at that point. Fernandez had as his background being head of the Vietnam clergy and laity concerned. So he had national organizing abilities. He had recognized most of us had known Dick in one capacity or another and knew his capacity to organize. And because he was available and because he had these talents, we agreed that to hire him. I think there were some hidden agendas going on at that point because there was always within the coalition the debate of whether this was a national cause in which we would try to work on a local solution, or whether this was a local battle that needed to be won and in turn affect the national cause. So that was always a debate, and Fernandez was a piece of that from the very beginning.
Was he screened? I mean, was there a committee that reviewed applicants? Or
The steering committee reviewed the applicants and, in fact, then and interviewed Fernandez and then subsequently hired Fernandez. He didn't get word of that until a couple of days later.
Who else do you recall was interviewed?
Who else was interviewed?
Yeah.
A fellow by the name of White from Akron. There was an individual who I cannot tell you his name now, it's long gone, who was a fellow out of the Southern United Presbyterian Church out of Atlanta, Georgia. And there was a number of other names,
But you interviewed quite a number of people then.
Well, I wouldn't say quite a number. I'd say we looked at a number of resumes, and we actually interviewed probably, as I can best recall, maybe four individuals directly.
What was the purpose of the Save Our Valley campaign?
The purpose of the Save Our Valley campaign, well, I think it's important to say how it emerged first. We were looking for a mechanism to demonstrate local support that would have far more effect than signing names on a petition. By the same token, if we were to move to any kind of investment, we needed to have some indications of potential investment to get people interested on a national investors level. By the same token, because of tax laws, we could not solicit any kind of pro forma to request investment or interest in investment. So that's really kind of the rock and the hard place. At a particular meeting, a breakfast meeting at Stanton's, I had been in dialogue with a number of the bankers and suggested, could there not be a way to create Christmas club type accounts where an individual could put money into a Christmas club? Whether they ever spent that money on Christmas presents or not was immaterial. They had at least suggested an intention. As a matter of fact, Jack Klinke, Vice President of Mahoning Bank, and I had talked about this idea, and in turn then I made the suggestion. Alperovitz did some refining of that, and we came up with these accounts that they did not have to be geared to any particular time in the year, i.e. Christmas, but it could be of like nature. Then we moved to what would we call it, and we came up with the idea of Save Our Valley. And then the final point was that we said, how would we monitor that? I took charge of meeting with the bankers and selling the product and soliciting from them the mechanism of how to do it. So that's the whole story.